From time to time, we come across something truly meaningful, something that just causes us to just stop and to think about the big questions of life. But when your mind is on the verge of just blowing with this, it's incredible how amazing and how big this universe is. And I hope what we saw this morning is something that stirs our imagination, or at least begins to stir in us the questions of, what is this all about? You know, we are in a tiny planet in such a vast and incredible universe, and we come up with these troubling questions when we think about these things. When we look up at the stars and we see the Milky Way, and we consider that there are some 100 billion galaxies with more stars than grains of sand on our entire planet, we begin to sense the weight of these thoughts and questions arise. Questions like, what is our place in the universe? Why is there a universe? Who made it? What is it for? These are the big and relevant questions as we search for meaning in life. Some time ago, there was a famous scientist named Carl Sagan, and he asked it this way. He asked, who are we? We find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. Who are we? What are we doing here? Carl Sagan was asking the big and relevant questions about our existence. And when we start tapping into these questions of our existence on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe, we can easily just become a little despondent, can't we? The sheer vastness of the universe and our little microscopic, seemingly insignificant spot in it, forgotten in the vast and stupendous space of it all, might become a little despondent about meaning when there's so much space. Popular atheist Richard Dawkins says it this way. We know from the second law of thermodynamics that all complexity, all life, all laughter, all sorrow is hell-bent on leveling itself out into cold nothingness in the end. They and we can never be more than temporary local buckings of the great universal slide into the abyss of uniformity. Sometimes we feel a bit about life that way when we consider our small place in such a big universe. For others, our lonely existence in such a vast and seemingly indifferent universe terrifies us. An ancient mathematician, Blaise Pascal, once articulated his own terror when he considers the vastness of the world and his own place in it. He says this, when I consider the short duration of my life, swallowed up in an eternity before and after, the little space I fill, engulfed in the infinite immensity of spaces whereof I know nothing and which know nothing of me, I am terrified. The eternal silence of these infinite spaces frightens me. Look, I'm not here to get you down this morning, but I do want you to be alert to the gravity of these questions that we ask as human beings. And we search for answers, and it's right that we search for answers to these big questions of why. Why do we populate this planet in such a vast and expansive universe? What are we doing here? Why do we exist? Who or what is behind it all? Those are great questions for humanity. Many have attempted to answer these big questions of our existence. Our current scientific consensus is with the Big Bang Theory, where everything popped into existence in a singular creation event. Ancient mythology tells us that creation is the result of warring gods, the sort of remnants of their wars between themselves. More adventurous theorists will speculate that this world and all that we know is merely a simulation. It's more like a Matrix movie kind of thing going on. We are just all stuck in a virtual world in the mind of a greater intellect. And we are just interactive characters making our way through a simulation. I don't know what your thoughts are on the big questions of existence and what you believe about why we are here. But if nothing else, we do know this. Humanity is as interested as ever to find out why we exist. We are as interested as ever to find where we came from and why we are here. This was no different for the ancient Hebrews of the Bible. What we find in Genesis is God's own account of the creation of the world and the reason why the universe exists, our purpose, and the who or what that initiated it all. As we consider this, then, I want us to be mindful. The ancient Hebrews did want to know this question as well. Moses wrote these words, we believe, and he accounts for the reason why they exist, or why we exist. What began it all? And we find for ourselves four main foundational concepts that Christians have always believed about creation itself. So what I want to do in our time for it is just to summarize four things that Christians always have believed about creation, and then summarize finally with one final thought about why we exist. So they are just four foundational things that I want us to know about. Things for you to carry away to understand what Christians believe about creation and God. The first thing is this. Genesis 1 tells us that creation is not a result of the conflict between warring gods or deities, as we might call them, or the undirected forces acting upon matter over time. There is very much direction to creation. Creation is the creative decision of one God alone. We see this in verse 1. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." This is important because the original hearers of this passage, the people who first read this, the Israelites under Moses' care, would come to understand the uniqueness of God, the God who had been leading them all this time. They would come to understand who he is and his uniqueness amongst all the other so-called gods that their neighboring nations believed in. Their God, they would discover, discloses himself in the scriptures, and he is singular. He is not in the company of other gods. He does not sit in a round table with other gods bantering about what decision to make about the creation of the world. He is singular and he acts independently of anyone else. So the Hebrews would learn, the Israelites would learn, that there is no other God besides God. They would learn that in the very first verse. Incidentally, this is the reason why God requires exclusive devotion from his people. When God commands Israel in the Ten Commandments, in the first one, he says this, "You shall have no other gods before me." We discover that God's commands are there to align us with reality. Don't worship any other gods, because there are no other gods. So God's commands align us with reality. And that's the first thing I want us to notice. Secondly, then, Christians have always believed that creation comes out of nothing. Or as Christians come to say, we use a Latin phrase called ex nihilo, out of nothing. Not emptiness, nothing. That's where it comes from. And this is implied in the very first verse by the words, God created. Since creation has a beginning, it did not have a previous form of existence. In the Christian view of things, there was nothing, not just an empty space, but nothing, not even empty space to put the nothing in. There was just nothing apart from God. And God, being God, was able to generate the whole created order, the vast expanse of everything that is, out of nothing. No raw ingredients to begin the process off. He simply spoke it into being. The Bible makes this explicit elsewhere, where it says this, "By faith we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what we see was not made out of things that are visible." This is important. Christians believe this is an important thing to remember, because it teaches us about God's power, about the kind of God that we worship, that he is able to bring about the whole world by simply speaking it into existence. He didn't go to a neighboring corner of a pre-existing universe and mine for minerals and then create another world somewhere else. He just speaks it into being. He is not like, for those of you who have seen the Lego movie, he is not like a Lego master builder that needs bricks and blocks to begin the process. He speaks the blocks into existence from nothing. Incidentally, a number of Big Bang scientists have found something remarkably similar in their own studies of the universe. As scientists look and the most predominant theory in the scientific world at the moment, being the Big Bang Theory, they find something remarkably similar in their own studies. And they have come, a number of them have said something like this, or very similar to this. This is a quote from one such scientist that says, "Before our universe, there was nothing. Nothing at all. Not even time itself." So as they peer back into time, and they consider their theory, they come to a point and they realize there was a time when time did not exist. There was just nothing. What a remarkable thing. This is our second point. It teaches us, as Christians believe, that God created all that is from nothing. We have always believed this. Thirdly, from our passage, we learn that creation is ordered. What an interesting thing to consider, that creation is ordered. which in turn tells us about the character of God. That God is an intelligent and ordered being. He is intelligent and he is ordered in the way that he does things. As we read in the chapter, we find rhythm, we find actions, we find sequence, we find that there is a goal and an end point that God has in mind. Verses 4 and 5 reads like this: God separated the light from the darkness, and he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And over and over and over in that chapter, you find rhythm and sequence to the way that God does things. So God was establishing an ordered pattern rather than unpredictable chaos. What a remarkable thing that we can depend on God that way. That we woke up this morning and we all just assumed that the sun would rise, didn't we? We just assumed, yeah, it's going to be another day. You know, it's going to be morning, afternoon, and nighttime. We just assume that this rhythm will always be there. Have you considered for a moment that even those things tell us something about God? That he is ordered, that we don't live in a chaotic universe, that he orders it all. What a remarkable thing. Assigning everything into a proper and fitting place, all from his own mind and creativity. What a wonderfully dependable God this must be. Fourthly then, our passage also teaches us the original goodness of the material world. Look at it in these words. How often do we read that God saw that it was good, and then finally he says it was very good? All that he created, all the physical stuff that he made, you know? He says it's good, it is very good. Again, this stands in contrast to religions that teach us that we must deny and escape the material and physical world, which is bad, and that we have to search for a transcendental spiritual reality which is good. That the spirit world is good, the material world is bad, and we've got to go in that direction, not in that direction. And Christianity, the religion of the Bible, would just say no, no, no. God has created the material world good. We are not to reject it, we are to embrace it, because God has made it good. We are not to withdraw from it. The physical world is good. And in the Christian view of things, even though we presently experience a diminished or a broken version of the material world, and we'll get to why it is that way in subsequent sermons, even though we understand that the material world isn't all that we want it to be right now, our cars rust and our houses decay if we don't pay attention to them. Even though the material world is decaying, even so, it is still good. The original intent of God is still for goodness in the material world. So these are the four things worth keeping in mind when it comes to understand what Christians believe about creation. Firstly, it comes from God, not warring deities. It comes into existence out of nothing by the powerful word of God. It is ordered and it reflects the character of God. And because God declares it good, we embrace the material world as good rather than something we are meant to escape or run away from. Those four things I want you to keep in mind as you think about what Christians believe about the created world. Though all this is true, we need to ask the question of our own purpose and place in this created universe. I mean, given the vastness, the sheer scale of this universe, and our seemingly infinitesimally small existence in it requires some explanation, doesn't it? I mean, as we watched that little video clip and you're just zooming out and out and out and we disappear as a speck on the horizon of vast universe, we want to ask the question, why? What are we doing here? We're not even in the middle. What are we doing here? Carl Sagan, again, I'll just quote him, he tried to answer that question of why. Or at least he was searching for an answer, a reason to explain. What are we doing on this tiny blue dot hurtling through space at goodness knows what rate? Why are we here? And as he looked at the vastness of the universe and human existence, he says this: the universe is a pretty big place. If it's just us, the universe seems like an awful waste of space. If it's just us. And it does seem that way, doesn't it? We keep putting up bigger radar dishes on the ground and sending telescopes further into space and dig up planets that we can't set foot on yet. And we just find a hollow echo coming back at us. So if it is just us in the vast universe, it does seem like an awful waste of space, doesn't it? Why make it so big? If all you needed was a little blue ball, why? Why make it like that? So Christians would take that question about our meaning and our existence in such a vast and expansive universe, and they look to the scriptures for an answer. Why is it that way? God himself alerts us to the answer to that question. I'm just asking you, as we read the first chapter, have you noticed who the central character of the chapter is? Have you noticed who the biggest player in the game is? In the first chapter of the Bible, it is God who takes central stage over and over and over again. Notice the inescapable priority that the chapter gives to God. Over and over, these are just a sample. It says that in the beginning, God created, God said, God saw, God separated, God called, God made, God finished, God blessed, and God rested. God is the primary and as he is given priority in the whole chapter. And because the Bible is written this way, because God takes central stage, we are supposed to learn something from that. Because God places himself at the center of the story, we are meant to learn something from that. That God is the central and most important person of the story. And this fact should inform the way we understand our own existence in such a vast universe. We must come to understand that there is a God-centeredness to creation and therefore to our existence. There is a God-centeredness to the whole created order and therefore to our existence. So God's answer to Carl Sagan's thought that the vastness of the universe is an awful waste of space is this. Listen carefully to this. We're nearly done. Just pay a little of attention now. To Carl Sagan's thought that the vastness of the universe is an awful waste of space, the Christian would answer, the vastness of the universe and our place in it is not meant to communicate our importance in the scheme of things, but the greatness and sheer grandness of God. Let me say that again. The vastness of the universe and our infinitesimally small place in it is not meant to communicate our importance in the scheme of things, but the greatness and sheer grandness of God. To quote one author, God made man small and the universe big to say something about himself. What a tremendous thought. What a tremendous thought. And for God to communicate that message is no waste of space. For God to take up so much room to declare his greatness is no waste. It is a glorious thing that he would do that and let us in on it. We remind ourselves of where we began this morning with a reading from Psalm 19. The songwriters of the Bible celebrated this fact when they wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God, not ours. The sky above proclaims his handiwork, not ours." What a glorious thought that God would alert us to that fact, that he is grand, that he is great. We are not at the center of it all. Let me close up with this thought. The Christian answer to the big and relevant questions about why we exist and what our purpose is none other than beholding God, our Creator, and relating to him aright as his creatures. That is what Christians believe, that we behold God, our Creator, and that we relate to him rightly as his creatures. That is what we were meant for as human beings. God says to us elsewhere, "I will say to the north, give up, and to the south, do not withhold. Bring my sons from afar and my daughters from the end of the earth, everyone who is called by my name, whom I created for my glory." We were created for God's glory, to behold it and to love it and to enjoy it and to just marvel at the greatness of his glory. That's why he made us, so that we could find our joy in beholding his goodness. It is a dreadful thing that we have turned our backs on this God and made attempts at creating a purpose for our lives without reference to him. That is the very essence of sin, that we have turned away from him and decided that we wanted to make our own meaning in life. But praise be to God, who through Jesus forgives this rebellion of ours, and he comes to restore our noble and grand purpose for which we were created, to glorify God by enjoying whom he has revealed himself to be in the scriptures.